Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Richard Dawkins, Charles Simone Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University, and we're going to be discussing the theory of evolution. Glad to have you with us. Perhaps it would be helpful to tell the listener a little bit about yourself, about your interest, and about your current position.
I'm a zoologist. I read zoology at Oxford. I spent time in the University of California as a young assistant professor. Returned to Oxford to teach zoology. Just within the last year, I've got a new job at Oxford endowed by Charles Simone to promote the public understanding of science. It's a thing I've been doing for a while anyway in writing my books, and I've done a fair number of broadcasts, some television, some journalism, and now I'm paid to spend all my time promoting the public understanding of science. I shall be concentrating especially on my own field of evolution, but I have an interest in the general understanding of science as well.
Okay. Well, the focus really of the show today is on the public understanding and, or in some ways you mentioned, the public misunderstanding of the theory of evolution. At least your last two books are aimed in some ways at exposing certain misunderstandings of the theory of evolution and then trying to give a positive account of what that theory is. What do you take it the primary misunderstanding of evolutionary theory is?
I think it's probably the idea that it's a theory of chance, luck, randomness. Everybody knows that randomness comes into the theory in mutation. But mutation is only the offering up of the variation upon which selection can act. The real essence of Darwin's theory is natural selection itself, and natural selection is exquisitely non-random. It is the non-random process to end all non-random processes. It is not a process of chance.
Okay. Well, let's look at the first part. Suppose it were a purely random process. Would it be a plausible theory?
Not at all. It couldn't possibly be, because what we're trying to do is to explain the immense complexity and the adaptive fit of organisms to their environment, the beauty and elegance with which every little detail of an animal or plant fits in to its way of life. These are structures that have all the appearances of being designed by a master engineer. Of course, it's why people like to believe they are designed by a master engineer. The theory of evolution by natural selection is the only plausible theory we have for how they come about, and it only works if we assume that there is a non-random process. There obviously has to be a non-random process, or you couldn't get this kind of adaptive complexity. So what opponents of Darwinism have done is to set up, well, not just a straw man, I mean a gigantic straw colossus, which is this idea that it's a chance process. And if you do that, of course, it's the easiest thing in the world to knock it down, because nobody but a fool would think that you could explain all this adaptive complexity by sheer chance.
Okay. Well, now, when you say it's a straw man, the implication is that people somehow know that that's not really what the theory of evolution is.
Perhaps that, yes, in that case that may be an unjust. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody who goes around saying that Darwinism is a theory of chance knows they're telling a lie. I suspect that some do. I suspect that some people who are sophisticated enough to run institutes of creation science and things know what they're doing and have some kind of hidden agenda. But I wouldn't wish to suggest that everybody who disbelieves in evolution is mendacious in some way. I think they've genuinely been misled. There are a lot of people out there who haven't the foggiest idea what Darwinism is, genuinely think that it is a theory of chance, in which case no wonder they don't believe it.
Okay, so for someone who doesn't know better, the fact that they don't believe the theory of evolution would not necessarily be irrational. That is, based on the evidence they have, on your own view, it would be inappropriate to believe in the theory.
That's true, except that they don't have to work very hard to get the evidence. I mean, there are plenty of good books out there to read. It's a kind of laziness to dismiss something without even looking at the most elementary book about it.
Okay, though I suppose perhaps here we don't need to get into psychologizing too deeply, but if you don't, for other reasons, don't want to believe the theory, then if you have what appears to be some sort of scientific objection to the theory, then you may be disinclined to look any further.
Could be.
Okay. Now, you pointed out, though, that it's, though chance plays a role in the theory of evolution. It is only part of the story. The main part of the story is natural selection. For those people who may not understand, who may not have picked up those books, could you briefly explain what the theory of natural selection is? And then we can talk about why it's not a random process.
Natural selection is the non-random survival. Natural selection is the non-random survival of randomly varying hereditary information. So as the generations go by, more individuals are born than can ever survive. Of that large population of individuals, the ones that survive are a non-random subset. They're the ones that are good at surviving, more generally the ones that are good at passing on their genes, which means surviving and reproducing. So as generations go by, the average animal, the average plant, becomes better at the art of survival, at the art of reproduction. Another way to put it is to say that we are, all of us, descended from successful ancestors. There's not a single one of your ancestors that wasn't successful in surviving and reproducing. Every one of your ancestors was attractive enough to find a partner to mate with, for example. Plenty of your ancestors, colleagues, contemporaries, were not successful, but all of your ancestors were. We are all descended from successful ancestors. We've all inherited what it takes to be a successful ancestor. We've all got the genes for being a successful ancestor. That's what natural selection is. That's why we're so good, by we I mean all animals and plants, that's why we're so good at surviving and reproducing in our different ways. I mean, some of us do it by swinging through the trees, some of us do it by swimming in the sea, some by burrowing underground. There are lots and lots of different particular ways of surviving and passing on the DNA that makes us survive. But in general, what we're doing, what we're all doing, is working for the preservation and propagation of our ancestors' DNA.
Okay. Now, another objection which someone has, and perhaps it's a variation of the one we've already talked about, and it's the one you really address in your latest book, Climbing Mount Improbable. Even if a person, the listener, might understand how natural selection might work on some small scale, they still may be disinclined to understand how we could go from some primeval soup to being as complex as we are as human beings, for example, and the other animals that inhabit the earth. Obviously, there has to be some process whereby we go from the bottom, to use your analogy in the book, to the peak of Mount Improbable. How does that happen using natural selection? Perhaps you might want to use some specific example. I know a couple that you use talk about a fair deal are flight and sight. Maybe you would want to use one of those, or if you have another.
In Climbing Mount Improbable, there are separate chapters, one on eyes, one on wings, one on fig trees. There are lots of different examples. They're all showing essentially the same thing. You have this this formidable problem of how you get from the bottom to the top of the mountain, how you get from no eye at all to a fully functioning eye, which is legendarily complicated, or how you get from no wings at all to the beautifully shaped wing of a swift or an albatross, which is beautifully tailored to do its job. It happens in a very large number of small cumulative stages. That's what moving up the mountain means. On one side of the mountain there's a sheer cliff which you can't jump up. Jumping from the bottom to the top would be a miracle. On the other side of the mountain there's a slow, gradual grade, and you move slowly up this grade. What that means is, if it's an eye, that every step, you may be 100 different steps, and each step is an eye which is a slightly better eye, slightly more efficient eye than the one before. Or up the wing slope, every step up the way, you go from rather cumbersome, clumsy gliding to more accurate gliding, to powered flight eventually, to powered flight with elaborate control. Each step of the way is just a slight advance on what happened before. By the time you have accumulated a sufficiently large number of these small micro steps in evolution, what you end up with is a very large advance, which if you thought about it as happening in one step, you would instantly see couldn't happen. But because you've managed to divide it up into lots of small steps, you've in fact tamed this problem and made it feasible. It is important to realize that there are a very, very large number of steps, and this takes a longer time than the human brain is ordinarily equipped to deal with. So we're not used to dealing in hundreds of millions of years, tens of millions of years, even millions of years. We're only used to dealing in, say, tens of years or hundreds of years. And we're so locked into thinking on this impoverished timescale that we find it very hard to grasp that although you might have an evolutionary change from a light-colored moth to a dark-colored moth, or from a slightly out-of-focus eye to a slightly better-focused eye, what people have trouble with is seeing that if you lay, say, 1,000 of those small steps end-to-end, one after another, then you can have a very, very large amount of change. There has got to be enough time. Geology gives us enough time. There are hundreds of millions of years over which evolution has taken place. You have to get your mind round that if you're going to really grasp what evolution is all about.
Okay. Now, you acknowledge that once you've got an eye, even if it's not very focused, you can understand how you might evolve a slightly more focused eye. But one of the questions that someone might have is, well, how did you ever start having an eye at all? If you went from something with no eyes, how did you ever get to the place where you even had the precursor of an eye?
You'd have to start with cells which were in no sense an eye, but which were sensitive to light. And there are lots of cells which are, in a generalized sort of way, sensitive to light. So they're just not seeing, but they're registering when there's light present. Perhaps we then have a multiplication up of those cells to form a flat sheet, just simply summing up their efforts so that they're capable of telling the animal whether it's night or day.
And there's an evolutionary advantage of being able to...
Oh, indeed, yes. It's certainly a very good thing to be able to time your activities differently, night from day. The next step then might be to be able to tell when a shadow has fallen. Because a shadow might be a predator. Next step would be to detect the direction the shadow falls from. Well, for that, you still don't need a lens. You still don't need a proper eye that can focus an image. But a slight cupping in the sheet of cells helps. Because if the sheet of cells is cup-shaped, then if the shadow falls from one side, you get a different pattern of responsiveness than if the shadow falls from the other side. Once you've got a cup, then by the same process of gradual step-by-step improvement, the cup can it fold over, enclose gradually until it becomes a pinhole. A pinhole camera is something that physicists know about, have done for a long time. It works. You can see a sharpish image, albeit a very dim one. There's a trade-off here between the dimness of the image and the sharpness. The smaller the pinhole, the sharper the image, but the less light gets through. So a pinhole camera works only in exceedingly bright light. The solution to that problem is to open the pinhole out but stick a lens in. A lens, as we think of it, is a very highly polished, highly ground, beautifully shaped object. But for this sort of purpose, any old blob, vaguely curved, vaguely transparent material is better than nothing. So once again, we have this slow, gradual working up slopes. You start with an amorphous blob of semi-transparent curved gunk, which is a good enough lens. It's better than nothing. And then once you're there, you're on the foothills of the slopes, and each step up the way, you gradually increase the transparency of the lens, gradually improve the curvature of it, get the curvature right, get rid of aberration. Each step is just a small advance on what went before. And the point is that it's easy to construct a continuous, unbroken series of steps from this primeval, light-sensitive cell right up to the modern, fully focused eye that we have.
Okay. Now, obviously, in some ways, the following analogy will be disanalogous, namely that involves human design. But in another way, I'm wondering if this will illustrate the point you're wanting to make. When you look at the Wright brothers' first attempt to fly, it's a very simple and not very effective means of getting off the ground. If you simply went and ask, could the Wright brothers' first plane turn into a Concorde overnight? The answer is going to be no. It couldn't have done it. There had to be
a large number of small changes accumulating over time to move from the Wright Brothers plane to the Concorde.
Well, yes.
And by the same token, what's common to the two is in the theory of evolution you have these small accumulative changes. What's different is that instead of having human design at each stage, you've got the process of natural selection.
Yes, I mean, the analogy is right as far as it goes, but of course you're right to emphasize that there's a dissonant analogy there as well, and I'd be sorry if people ran away with the idea, see, you need a designer after all, because it's true that that to go from Wright Brothers to Concorde, it has to be done gradually, but that's almost a coincidental fact about the way human minds work. The minds of inventors in the time of the Wright brothers could theoretically have thrown away the drawing, got a clean drawing board and designed a Concorde, but couldn't have done it because they didn't have all the intermediate knowledge. But I think in a way it's better not to use that analogy.
Okay.
Because it might positively mislead people.
Well, all right, let's go back then. I mean, obviously what's disanalogous is you got this process of natural selection other than design. Maybe we need to say a little bit more about that for the listener. I mean, what exactly differentiates natural selection? I mean, if someone said to you, okay, explain to me more about this process.
Well, I mean, one thing you could say is that if you're asking me to differentiate it from design, one thing is that it has no foresight. It's purely short-term benefit. So at any particular time, the individuals that survive and reproduce are the ones who pass their genes on. So if, for example, a designer, like an aircraft designer, is capable of looking ahead and saying, I think that the propeller engine is finished and I'm going to throw it away and begin again with the jet engine. Now, designers can do that. They can simply throw away the propeller engine and with a clean drawing board start afresh. Evolution can't do that. Natural selection can't do that. It would have to take whatever it's got already, and if we're sticking with the airplane analogy, change the propeller engine into the jet engine by removing one screw at a time, one nut at a time, one rivet at a time, and changing it. Well, you possibly could go from a propeller engine to a jet engine, but it would be a pretty odd jet engine that you ended up with.
Right.
And yet that's the constraint that natural selection has to work under. The animals that you look at are walking museums of their past. They're carrying the load of history around in them. They're not perfect because they're not designed from scratch as if with foresight. They're designed step by step from whatever was there in the past, and so that you've got relics of the past tinkered with, modified piecemeal step by step, and the result may be far from the most efficient thing that an engineer could have imagined.
Okay, I think that's important because one of the explanations of why evolution is a better, why evolutionary theory is a better explanation is that the results are not perfect. They're not in the way you'd expect them to be. Could you give a couple of examples of the inefficiency in this case of evolution?
Yes. The recurrent laryngeal nerve is one of the branches of one of the cranial nerves, and it supplies the larynx, and it comes from the brain ultimately. But instead of going straight from the brain to the larynx, it goes right down into the chest, loops its way around a major blood vessel in the chest, and then goes back up to the larynx. In a giraffe, as you can imagine, the recurrent laryngeal nerve is ridiculously long. I mean, it's yards long. And this is clearly an inefficiency. It cannot be good design. It slows down the rate of flow of nerve impulses from one end of the nerve to the other. It must use up extra material, uses up extra space. It's bad design. It is simply a historical legacy in some remote ancestor of ours that the shortest route that the ancestral nerve could take was at the far at the lower side of at the posterior side of this blood vessel, and then as the neck has lengthened, especially in the giraffe, as the neck has lengthened over evolutionary time, the trauma, the upheaval of changing the embryology so that the nerve takes a quite different route was too great, and it was simpler and easier less costly in the short term. For each at each marginal increase in the neck length, let the nerve become just that little bit longer, a little bit longer, a little bit longer. At every stage, the marginal cost of elongating the nerve by one more inch was less than the marginal cost of the major upheaval, which would have been implicit in the back to the drawing board kind of root and branch change.
Okay, could you give maybe one more example for the listener? I think this is very important.
Flatfish of the sort of sole place halibut kind they live on the bottom and they get a good living flat on the bottom of the sea. They live on one side, unlike say a skate, which is originally a shark that's lay down on its belly and flattened out sideways. Sole and place lie on one side, so that their eye looks, the eye on one side looks down into the sand, the other eye looks up where it should, and this is clearly wasteful, that eye can't see anything useful. So what's happened in evolution is that the eye has moved its way around. And the whole...
One other misconception of the theory of evolution that I'd like you to talk about a bit, we're down to about the last two and a half minutes here. People are inclined to see the theory of evolution as sort of a monolithic theory that is more or less unchanged in the past at least 40 or 50 years, maybe all the way back to the time of Darwin, and that basically all evolutionists agree on all points. I tell you, this is a serious misconception.
Yes, but of course it's not true that they all agree. As in any other flourishing science, there is plenty of disagreement of detail. But it is important not to run away with the idea that because there are disagreements of detail, go to the other extreme and say that because there are disagreements of detail, therefore the whole thing can't be worth anything. All evolutionists agree that it's happened. All evolutionists agree that we are all living creatures on Earth today, humans, kangaroos, oak trees, bacteria, we're all cousins of each other. We all descend from a common ancestor who lived between 3,000 million and 4,000 million years ago. Nobody disputes that. Nobody disputes that natural selection, Darwinian natural selection, is the only theory we have, the only workable theory that accounts for adaptation. There is disagreement about whether there are other forces apart from natural selection that are important in guiding evolution, but everybody agrees that natural selection is the only one that can guide it in the direction of adaptive improvement. There are numerous details of disagreement, and I'm really glad there are. There's plenty of things that one can argue about, waiting for new evidence, pointing out points of logic, but there is no disagreement that evolution is a fact. Evolution has happened. We are all cousins.
Okay, so the basic, if you will, the basic tenet of the theory is something that everyone seems to agree on, but that there is an ongoing debate about exactly how the process of evolution occurs.
Yes.
And that's a sign of a flourishing science.
Yes.
It's not something you would expect from dogma.
Exactly.
Okay. We just got a minute here. Sort of a one-minute summary of what you'd like the listener to take away from what you've said.
As I've traveled around America, I've sometimes come across hostility to the idea of evolution. But it nearly always turns out on closer examination that this is an honest hostility that's based upon ignorance. There are people who are out there with their own agendas of propaganda, religious propaganda, and I set them on one side. But for most people, I think the misconceptions are really largely because they simply haven't been exposed to the information of what evolution is all about. It's an extremely simple theory. It's not difficult to understand. The main reason many people don't understand it is they've quite simply never been exposed to it. It's been left out of their education, and this is very sad.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing on the show.
Thank you.
I've been talking today with Richard Dawkins, Charles Simone Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.